Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. I'm Yaz Rana, and later on the show we'll be hearing from the great Sir Isaac Vivian Alexander Richards. But first up, to discuss T20Is, selection philosophy, air pollution and much more, I'm thrilled to be joined by regular guest, CricViz analyst Ben Jones. Hello Ben, how are you?
I'm very well, Yaz. Thanks for having me back.
Fantastic. And for the first time, a Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast newbie, the commentator and presenter Michael McCann. Welcome Michael, what was your moment of the week?
My moment of the week was the Nasser Hussain Parkinson speech. I just thought it was lovely. I think everyone who's seen it knows what I mean. If you haven't, go and watch it. Presents him his cap, talks about the journey. It was really poignant. It was really lovely. And the way he referenced the throwdowns and the people that have got him there as well, you know, I just thought it was perfect, really. What a way to get your cap.
Absolutely. So at the time of recording, we're three games into that T20I series between England and New Zealand. New Zealand are 2-1 up after England won the first game in the series. James Mintz with a half century in that game. Chris Jordan took 3 for 23 and hit a rapid 36 in a narrow England defeat in the second game at Wellington. And finally, England collapsed in some style in the most recent fixture at Nelson, falling from 130, 9 for 2 in the 15th over to 166 for 7 at the end of the innings to lose that by 14 runs. Ben, two questions. We've had five England debutants: Pat Brown, Matt Parkinson, Saqib Mahmood, Lewis Gregory and Tom Banton. Actually six if you include Sam Curran, who has somehow never played a T20I before. First, who's impressed you the most? And number two, who do you think is most likely to go on the plane to Australia for the World Cup next year?
Oh God, it's hard, isn't it? I think part of it, it's a bit difficult to assess these guys so early because we're judging them on their first ever step up. But I think we've all kind of put our cards on the table ahead of the series and said we're all most excited about Tom Banton, probably. And because, you know, he's 8 foot tall, he smashes it to every part of the ground, he's kind of terrified anyone who's come to Taunton in the last year or so. And he looked good, but, you know, not all that. Parkinson looked skillful and everything that we've seen in the Blast, maybe a little bit slow, but like that's something that he's going to develop as he works with maybe slightly higher profile coaches, etc., etc. And I think that's kind of the pattern we've seen across all the debutants, including Sam Curran, to be honest, as a young bowler, because, you know, he's obviously played a lot of international cricket, but he's not played a lot of white ball cricket. Mm. It's been that sense of these guys have come in, they've shown what we thought they'd do. No one's gone massively over the top and done incredibly well and got a ton, and no one's taken 8 for. We've all kind of done what we expected. Pat Brown's bowled tidily, had a couple of bad spells where you think, oh, is he quite up to it? But we all know that he definitely is. That's why he's there. And I think it kind of comes back to that thing of when you're judging players on a fairly small sample size, which T20 naturally lends itself to because the games are so short, it's really difficult to come to conclusions, which is why the next few games are probably just as important as the first three, because we need to, I don't know, almost stick with the same team, give them more of a chance to express their skills, and then kind of assess things then, rather than trying to jump to anything now and get the bandwagon rolling.
Mm. Michael, what about you? Who's impressed you the most in the series?
I am going to sidestep that question and actually go off the back of what Ben said about the bandwagon, in that I think that there is a danger that the media can sort of lead a charge on a player based on, I'm going to say limited information, but what I more mean is kind of referencing what you said about keeping the team the same. I mean, you're already dealing with a very small sample size in terms of someone like Banton, who has come and shone in a very short space of time. And now you're dealing with an even smaller sample size than that in terms of their international exposure. So I think it's more about actually giving us time and a better opportunity to judge all of them. Parkinson is the one that I see. I can envisage him and Rashid. And also you've got the 2021 World Cup in India. So again, that kind of lends itself quite nicely to, I can imagine you having Parkinson and Rashid and potentially Moeen Ali, and maybe, depending on the pitch, you could even go four spinners. There's this very old school traditional thing of like, we need to have more seam bowlers than spinners. And it's good to see that that's starting to be eroded away by T20. The change can't come quickly enough. You know, it goes back to this old school thing from here at the Oval where you'd be like, well, we'd have our championship team, we'd have four seamers and we'll have a spinner. And now I think you're increasingly seeing T20 attacks becoming more three and three split, or even a three spinners, two seamers with one as a part-timer type of thing. And having Parkinson in the England T20 team is a good reflection of that change.
The best thing about Parkinson going forward as well, for him, from his perspective, is that the replacement level of his skill in English cricket is a lot worse. Yep. Because if you're Pat Brown, you've got to overcome Chris Jordan, who's been
a good death bowler for quite a few years. You've got Tom Curran, who's a good death bowler and has played in leagues around the world. And Pat Brown's kind of starting out on that journey.
You've got people like Timo Mills.
Well, exactly. You've got a lot of people who are very talented ahead of him. With Tom Banton, it's a similar story to Pat Brown. You've got loads of top-order talent. With Parkinson, it is basically, if he can nail this series, he's going to partner Rashid in the squad and potentially the team, along with Moeen Ali, you'd expect. So I think we've got to kind of be careful that we don't leap into being like, oh, Parkinson's definitely done really, really well, because we kind of need him to, because there's no one else at the moment.
Looking at kind of where England have strength in numbers, I agree with all that, but one spot where England don't potentially know what to do with is the finisher role. Who bats 5, 6, 7 in that T20 side? You'd imagine Moeen will probably end up batting 7 like he did in the ODI stuff.
I would be surprised if he batted that low. I think he'll bat up, because I think in T20, I mean, A, he's a better T20 player than he is an ODI player, and because he has the very specific skill set of absolutely smashing spin. It's something like, I think only Cameron Akmal hits it harder and hits it faster against spin in the last few years. And I think England needs someone to come in when they're 3 down and they're getting a bit stodgy. Like, some of the Australian pitches will be a bit stodgy next year. They're not all going to be absolute roads. I genuinely don't know who will bat at 7. I think by the looks of things, they want it to be Lewis Gregory, but I mean obviously he's starting out. We don't know whether he's going to be up to it. He could be amazing and he could solve it. I think basically it's there for anyone who wants it, because there aren't many elite English finishers around at all.
But see, I think this is part of the problem. So many of these players are batting 3 or 4 for their counties. You look at someone like Sam Curran, and he'll bat 3, 4, sorry. And that's great. And he had a very decent blast with the bat last summer. But all these players are batting 3 or 4 for their counties. And that number 6 role is such a unique role and skill, which is going to lead me to throw something out there that Joss Butler fans might hate me for. And I'd be really interested to know what your numbers would say about this, Ben, because this is not necessarily quantified by numbers. But if Joss opens, there are other people that can do the job Joss Butler broadly does as an opener, in terms of striking at in the region of 150 and averaging in the region of 30. But he's the best finisher in the world. There's no one else that can come in at strike at 2 runs a ball plus in the last 5 overs, score at 360 degrees all the way around the wicket. Whereas you have guys like Hales and Bairstow and Roy who can do that opening role. So to me, I think if you're Joss Butler, the traditional way we still look at metrics, which is really misguided, and statisticians like Ben are starting to move past this, and other analysts, rightly so, is, you know, the person that scored the most runs does the best. The IPL still gives that a purple cap for the most runs, which you can argue is a bit ridiculous, frankly. So if you're Joss Butler and you get asked, do you want to open the batting? You're obviously going to say yes, because that's still the way everything's looked at. But actually, I would make the case that England are much better off having someone like Butler at 6.
Six is too low, though, for me.
But wherever the last, you know,
coming in the 15th over.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say.
I think the equation that you're essentially trying to work out is the net gain for England better if you have, because they've got a lot of top order players, like you say. They're kind of trying to cram Jason Roy and Johnny Bairstow and potentially Tom Banton into that top order. I mean, Alex Hales, you know, if he comes back, you've got all those guys who could do a really good job. Is the net gain of putting Butler at 6, 7, that kind of floating finisher role, does that improve them? The issue is, I think it will end up being either someone like Gregory or Butler will have to kind of bite the bullet and go down, because Morgan struggles to accelerate at the start of his innings. Stokes struggles to accelerate at the start of his innings. Essentially, you've got guys who are very, very good in what they do in different roles, but aren't necessarily as suited. Whereas Butler, despite the fact that he's obviously the most valuable player within that England side, and you want to give him as many balls as possible to do what he can do, and that's why Rajasthan put him up, and that's why England then put him up, and that's why he's done so well in the last year or so. But at the same time, he's probably the best suited player to doing that role. It's a really tricky one, but like, that's kind of why they need to nail giving Gregory a go, because if he works, then they've solved it. Yeah. Just to leap back to what we were saying about the kind of Sam Curran batting up the order. For one, Curran himself is a bit of a misnomer, because he also opened the batting for Kings 11 this year, because that's a bit of a pinch hitter. So he is like a quality attacking batsman, and it would be harsh to denigrate the blast and the standard of that based on purely current, but there are other examples. And I wrote about this recently, got a lot of criticism and kind of people kind of slightly pushing back against it because people love the Blast and have a real affinity and affection for it. But it does affect the kind of players that are coming through. Like we say, like someone like Banton, he probably is a top order player, but if he'd come through in a league with a smaller league with fewer teams, he probably would have made his debut a bit like how Joe Root did in the test side, kind of coming in at six and kind of you get a bit of a glimpse of him and then you push him up and you give him a better chance. I think the Blast has an issue in that it doesn't necessarily produce that kind of player. So it's not a fatal flaw, but I think it's a slight problem.
For the record, Butler bats four for me in my T20 side. For kind of using your logic, in that England have a lot of high quality opening batsmen, great, but I want Butler to have as many balls as possible.
So if it's two for two, is he coming in for you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, I understand why.
He's a class
act. Yeah.
Linked to what you were saying about the varying qualities of leagues, being a selector in T20 international cricket is so different for any other format of international cricket in that you have so many leagues around the world that are varying standards. And also, if somebody scores runs in a test match for England, that increases their chances of staying in the team long term. Whereas in T20s, you can't really say that because the quality of these random bilateral series isn't as high as the IPL, as simple as that. And how do you compare performances in different leagues? David Milan, for example, somebody scored five. He's fifth in England's all-time list of 50-plus scorers in T20i cricket. But he might not even get into the World Cup squad. It's very difficult to assess these players, particularly when the pool is probably larger in T20s than it is for any other format.
And it's a bit like in the football, like with people like Gareth Southgate, will keep players who've played well for England in the squad for a little bit longer, even though there's a kind of flavour of the month, whether it's James Maddison or someone coming through, and they're like, "Well, you've got to get him in there," and he's like, "Well, hang on."
It's like Andrews Townsend under Roy Hodgson.
Yeah, they've not done incredibly at their club, but they've played well for me. And so England have basically got to make a call with someone like David Milan, where every time he plays for England in 2020, he does a good job. But actually, every time he plays in a T20 league that isn't the Blast, he really struggles. His numbers are really poor. And so it's which one of those do you place greater emphasis on? And I don't think either is right or wrong, but that's kind of the deal of being an international coach, is you've got to make that call and kind of live or die by it.
And the selector's job is very difficult as well, because historically, a selector watches England games and English domestic games. But there are so many English players going to leagues like the PSL now.
Well, that's the problem, because previously was, broadly speaking, there was two ways of assessing someone. They either had a full county season, and that was basically how you looked at them, or they'd had a full international season with the England team, as, say, a summer. You know, and then winter, unless you were on an England tour, nothing much would really happen in the era before T20 franchise leagues. You might go and play for club stint or whatever, but it wasn't looked at in the way that we would look at the IPL or the Big Bash or et cetera, et cetera. And now that's all been thrown open because you have someone like Harry Gurney. So how do you look at him? Or Tom Curran for the Sydney Sixers, I think it was, a while back. He had the winter before last, I think it was, where he was excellent. And the next World Cup's in Australia. Rashid has a ridiculously good record in Australia. So the way I'd summarise it is England players used to play in England or for England. That was it. If you weren't playing in England, you were in an England shirt. So quantifying the whole thing was a lot more simple. And you might have the rare floater who was kind of between the England team and the county setup. And now you have a guy like Harry Gurney. So how do you go and compare that to, say, Chris Jordan, who's, you know, playing in the Blast and then in T20Is, you know.
Oh, that's a really good point. Really good point. I think it'll be very interesting what the process is like. Is with the 50-over World Cup, it was clear a long way out who the 15-ish players were, 16, 17 with the odd bolt, like the baby David Willey who didn't get picked for the eventual squad. With the T20, genuinely there's a pool of 30 players who probably think they're in with a shot.
And also, how many was it for the 50-over World Cup? Was it a squad of 17?
15.
Was it 15 as well?
It's 15 plus David Willey and Alex Hales was basically your pool.
But that is bizarre. But I mean, it's probably for the best, really, in terms of the competitive balance of the tournament, because it means that the bigger nations and the better nations can't just load their squad up. But it does mean that, like, there are some really good players who just don't get to go. And it means that, you know, there's probably a slight loss in the quality of cricket there, which is a bit of a shame. Someone like David Willey might not go, and he's one of the best new ball bowlers in the world. He's not necessarily in fashion at the moment, but his numbers are amazing. So it may be going forward, as T20 gets more and more respected and seen as, like, the most strategic, tactical form of the game, squads will be allowed to get bigger. And we, I mean, we're seeing, we'll probably talk about it later, but stuff with the IPL in terms of the pools of players that are going to be drawn on. The more players you have that are in and around the game, in and around the cricket field, who are good, it's only going to improve the product and improve the experience of watching it.
Well, to be slightly more, slightly sort of nuanced about it, I guess I would...
Is Ben not nuanced?
I was going to say, I didn't think I was that full on.
What I more meant is, so you were saying like the quality... You won't get as, you know, because of the bigger pool. I suppose it's more that you, because you have a smaller squad, you're not able to have a squad that caters more better for different types of situations. You have all these different cricketers who are all of an incredibly high quality, but I guess you would in certain situations be missing a cricketer of a particularly high quality for a particular type of situation.
It forces teams to make a strategic choice. It forces them to develop a style, because actually you can't have someone to cover. You can't cover all bases. Yeah. So
it's great for Sam Billings. Well, he can bat 1-7.
Does a bit of everything. Keeps like, and that's the thing. And does everything pretty well. But the point is that you've potentially got someone like India who could pick a bowling heavy side. They could pick a batting heavy side. They could pick a side that's going to win at the Chinnaswamy. They could pick a side that's going to win at the Chipout. They could pick any team for different styles, but they've got to kind of hedge their bets a little bit, which does make for a bit of a strategic kind of, I don't know, like throw something into the mix, which hopefully makes it more interesting.
Well, that is very interesting. We talked a lot longer on England's T20 squad than I thought we would.
That's all, folks.
Early in the week, I had the pleasure of speaking to the great Sir Viv Richards about his career. So here is that chat. So first of all, Sir Viv, pleasure to have you with us on the show. First of all, I'd like to ask you about how you developed your cricket as a youngster. So when you were growing up, when you were learning the game, did you have anyone in particular who had a profound impact on your cricket as a child?
Yeah, first of all, let me say good morning to you and hopefully our listeners. It's great to be here at World Travel Market again, WTM, as a representative of my country, Antigua and Barbuda. And just very special to be here doing this interview with you as well. This is my first in terms of with the mic. And what was the question again?
Question was, as a youngster growing up, learning the game, do you have anyone in particular who had a profound impact on your cricket as a child?
My dad, he was a cricketer himself. He played for Antigua and Barbuda. And when you have someone of that particular stature in your family, he was pretty knowledgeable also, and the sort of inspiration that I needed. That was the first beginning. Then there are certain steps as you go along, as you obviously try and represent what's happening in your professional life.
Was he quite hands-on with you as a kid, or was it more in terms of he inspired you in terms of the attitude he instilled in you growing up?
Well, I think attitude plays a huge part. Never to have fear, to believe in what you were doing. And these are some of the homegrown skills that were available at that time. And I took it on board, because who else... Your parents, I've always believed, for their kids, would want to drive them in the right direction. And no parent, in my opinion, would want your kid to go in the opposite direction. So I think they did all the necessary things for me to get by.
I read that you worked in a restaurant when you were 18.
Yeah.
Did having a proper job teach you anything or give you an added sense of perspective before you started your international career?
Well, at that time, I was in when I just left school, you know, you're looking for, we had a restaurant which was known as the Kensington Restaurant, which was on St. Mary Street in Antigua. And for some reason, it was a place that prepared me for what I think I needed to be. I didn't want to be there spending the rest of my life as a waiter at the time, because it was something I did when I was in school also, especially when we had school vacation. You would make sure that this guy was a cricket lover, so he made sure that he had me around. But I did not want that to be the final sort of play in my life. So as we went on, things progressed, and maybe why I'm speaking with you today, that things got a little bit better, or much better, you may say.
But a lot of the great players now probably didn't have experiences like that working normal jobs. So do you think that... players would benefit from doing that now, and do you think you had a kind of an advantage for having quite a real upbringing and experiencing a job that most people experience but not most professional cricketers?
Well, sometimes it depends on the individuals themselves. Sometimes you can have a bad start in life and it's about the finish. I think sometimes you can start some pretty good in life, and then the opposite. Playing here in England for the first time and things, different conditions. So it was more, there's a lot of thinking and a lot of things that you had was to do to get by.
So I was going to ask you about your time in England. How influential do you think that was in terms of your overall career?
England was a great place to be. I've always felt as a little boy that listening to West Indies tour in England, hearing John Ollett, the late John Ollett, speak about or describe what cricket was all about coming from Lords and all that sort of stuff. So as a little boy and then as a Caribbean individual with representatives from the region playing, wow, you take it on board and you made sure that the things that you heard are some of the stuff which still lives with me today.
What kind of stuff still lives with you today?
Oh, well, you hear John Ollett described maybe as a Gary Sobers. You hear him describe maybe a Conrad Hunt, a Wes Hall, all those little things, especially Wes Hall and the big medallion on his chest and running in to some guys who felt at the time that they were sentenced to death because of what Wes Hall and Charlie Griffiths had then. So all those little descriptions, you know, lived with me for quite some time, yeah.
And then about the start of your international career when you made your debut for the West Indies, did you feel like you were ready for international cricket when you made your debut, or do you think you were finding your feet a little bit at the time?
Well, I started in India at the time. We toured 1974, if I'm correct in saying. I don't think I was ready. I don't think I was ready for 70,000 people in Bangalore, 90,000 people in Calcutta. I wasn't ready for that, you know. These were more people than where I lived, you know, in terms of the population. So it was a huge awakening, and I guess that these are the things that you need, the barriers that you need early on in life to give you a kick up the backside, whether or not you're going to make it or whether you like to make it or not. So these were the little things which helped to drive you wanting to succeed.
You obviously got accustomed to it pretty quickly, though.
Oh, yeah.
Why was that? Why was it that you became so accustomed to the big stage?
Because I wanted to succeed. You know, I wanted to succeed. And I had enjoyed the adulation of such from the crowds. And, wow, who wouldn't want to do well in front of 70,000 people? You know, so I didn't want to make it that I was a failure because there was this multitude of people. I wanted to make sure that, wow, what these 70 or 80,000 people would have seen today that will live with them for a long period of time. So, Viv, you've got to get your act together, yeah.
There were periods of over your career where your numbers with the bat were just staggering. So 1976, that was a record number of runs scored by anyone in Test cricket for 30 years, I think. Around the turn of the decade as well, your numbers were just incredible. Did you kind of feel invincible at times of your career? And what was it about those periods in particular was different to the other times of your career?
Well, that was, I guess, when you're younger, there's a lot of things happening in your life. And as you get older, sometimes the deteriorating factor does come in. When you're younger, I think we're at our best. Our body is feeling also at its best. And as you go along in life, the wears and tears sometimes becomes as a deterrent. You do not quite accomplish the things that you were able to do when you were whatever, you know, at that younger age in life. But the things which would be of great help also is that the older you get, that little experience factor, the experience that you would have had plays a huge part, making out it would help you to prepare you also, even though you would not be that fit. But because of the experiences you would have had, helps you to manage how you would like to progress.
You're talking a lot about the mentality, the mental side of the game, but what about technically with the bat? Were there any technical things that
you... Technical's okay, you know. I didn't place... When I wanted to be technical, I can be technical. Technique, to me, especially when you're looking to defend, there are certain things you had to be quite precise about being technical. nice close button pad. Because I've always leveled my game at two things, really. It's when I'm on the attack, I prepare my mind for being on the attack. When I'm on the defensive, because there are times you need to do that. So you separate both. Defense is a defense. And when you're on the attack, it's on the attack. Sometimes you see some guys are defending and still trying to get something out of defending, like trying to push to the line. Defense, in my opinion, that's why it's called a defense. You know?
Do you ever feel out of form?
Yeah, there are times you do.
And what do you do when you're out of form to get yourself back into
it? Well, you try and remember the good things and you to try and eliminate the things which would have helped you to fail. You try and eradicate that as best as you can. And I've tried that on numerous occasions. You know, it is quite special at times when you're able to balance the things that you want to accomplish and the things that you think you should throw through the door. And hard work pays a part.
There's a question about the 1975 World Cup. It's something quite interesting because you won the World Cup and in the final you were a hero with three runouts. But you averaged 12 or something with a bat in that World Cup. Was taking pride in your fielding something that you took very seriously from a young age?
Yes. Yes, fielding, I think, is of vital importance. You know, and as you can see, those runouts were like 6 wickets.
Yeah.
You know, at
and
the
did
time,
you think you took fielding more seriously than perhaps other people?
No, it doesn't matter. It's just the fact that I don't think I would have been an established batsman then. You know, I was still playing second fiddle to a whole lot of guys, the Rohan Kanais and all the other great West Indian players. But it was the fact being in that team as a young guy and not contributing with the bat, there were other aspects of the game in itself that I felt, wow, the Australians gave you an opportunity. And because of that practice you had previously, you were able to accomplish those three runouts.
Cool. Thank you very much, Viv.
Good, my brother, man.
Cheers. Thank you.
Good to see
you,
my brother, man.
Vivic was pretty good. What one thing that I found quite interesting when I was researching for the interview was how badly he did in the 1975 World Cup, considering he was a key player in the final. He was behind three important runouts that he said were basically worth 6 wickets. But he only averaged 12 in that World Cup, and I thought it was quite interesting how much that he kind of felt responsible to make an impact in the field when he hadn't done anything with a bat for the entirety of the tournament. Ben, I remember we had a conversation last year about Virat Kohli. You said he's arguably the best ODI batsman of all time, and I said, well, there's Viv Richards as well, and obviously there's de Villiers too, but from the 20th century he is the standout.
Oh yeah, I think at the time I was a bit more emphatic in terms of saying that, like, Kohli's inarguably, like, he is the greatest, but it's recency bias, isn't it? And watching Kohli twice a month kind of thing, of course I'm going to think he's the best when his numbers are that good. But you look at Richards's performances over that time, and he was playing a different sport in a way that Kohli isn't now. Kohli's mastered this version, but Richards was a kind of glimpse into the future. Yeah, I mean, we're not bringing up anything new. Viv Richards was very good at batting, but it is kind of, I don't know, it's a nice one to kind of keep in the discussion, as like just to add a bit of texture to the idea that, like, well, if Kohli makes a billion hundreds in ODI cricket and averages a million when he's chasing, then there's still that thing we can go back and be like, yeah, but if Richards had been playing in the era of, like, bigger bats, smaller boundaries kind of thing. But then again, he'd been playing against bowlers that go around the world earning millions of pounds bowling Yorkers, which he wasn't really at the time. So
yeah. Moving on to Bangladesh's series in India, T20I series in India. From a purely cricketing point of view, it was notable. The first game of the series was notable, and that Bangladesh won it. It's their first game since Shakib was banned for a year, so that was impressive in its own right. But the story that is more important and overrides anything that happened on the cricket field was the fact they even got on the field in the first place. The air quality in Delhi at the moment is horrendous. There were calls for the game to be postponed. Former Indian bowler Ashish Nehra has even moved out of the city of Delhi because the air quality there is so bad. Ravi Ashwin has been very vocal on social media, as vocal as Indian players ever get, really, on social media. He said, the quality of air in Delhi is really scary. The oxygen we breathe is the basic requisite for mankind on this planet. This indeed is an emergency. Sourav Ganguly, the new president of the BCCI, thanked both players from both teams after the game for playing the game in what he called tough conditions. I think there's a broader point here. With the climate emergency, they're going to be cricket, the sport is very vulnerable to climate change. Increased temperatures in countries are already very hot, and air quality problems. Do you think that cricket is going to have to implement regulations where we'll just see cricket not being played in places where it used to be played regularly?
I mean, that's the trend, isn't it? That's what's going to happen, unless things far more important than far above cricket radically change. Mm-hmm. Tanya Aldred has done fantastic work on this, and spoke very well about it on Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon's podcast recently. And there's a lot of good writing out there, so I would urge people to kind of get stuck into. But it's hard to be kind of, you know, even glib or kind of think briefly about it, because it immediately just kind of brings into perspective the kind of futility of what we're all doing here. And actually the concern of it, at the risk of demolishing this conversation, it just makes you think, kind of, actually, does it, the effect of the climate on cricket is so minuscule, really, in the broader scheme of things.
Absolutely, I'm not claiming otherwise, but
I know it's just hard to sit here and think, well, you know, the ball's going to probably swing a little bit less with the in white ball cricket with the roasting temperatures around the world. But yeah, in terms of hope, I suppose
the flip side of it.
Well, that's what I was about to say. Do you get to a point where actually, like, we have a light meter for whether we go back out in a test match, we actually have an air quality meter and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And the flip side of it, I would say as well, is that because cricket has such a voice in parts of the world which are going to be deeply affected by it, and perhaps earlier than other parts of the world, that does give it a responsibility to talk about these things. And it's good that this particular game hasn't been shrouded in kind of, it hasn't been all lumped in on Delhi as like, oh, it's their fault. It has brought about a wider discussion. And that's, you know, sometimes these things can suddenly get very parochial and we're just talking about like, well, do Delhi need to change their regulations? And it's like, no, it's a bit bigger than that.
Yeah, it's a symptom. Because it also reminded me of that test, which was in Delhi a couple of years ago against Sri Lanka, where they were for 3 or 4 days whilst Kohli assembled a massive double ton, as per usual, they were regularly on and off, and it was all pretty horrible, and it all got a bit, some of the stuff towards the Sri Lankan players got a bit nasty when they were generally just actually like struggling to breathe. I mean, I've had the privilege of going and working in India on a hockey tournament a couple of years ago, and being over there for a couple of work things since, and had travelled there on holiday a few times when I was younger, so I've been there a lot, north, east, south and west, and have been to Delhi as part of that, and you really do notice it. I mean, it's just you can't not. And I have to say, you know, as a kid who kind of understood broadly what climate change was and has heard about it and the rest of it, then went on a family holiday to India when I was 15 and went to Delhi. And then I got out of the airport and it was sort of explained to me, oh, this is kind of the sort of thing that happens from that. And as a 15-year-old kid, then you really were like, oh my god, you know, you couldn't. And I mean, if that kind of thing, even if you're someone that doesn't really believe in the need to kind of think about how you do things and your impact on the world, if that kind of thing doesn't impact you, I don't know what will. I mean, it's pretty scary.
I was just going to say, in terms of, like you're saying, you don't necessarily realize the extent of these situations until you're in them. And a lot of what climate photography and journalism and writing about the climate emergency is trying to convey that. And actually cricket, by the fact that it's being broadcast around the world, if you're seeing the Sri Lankan team or you're seeing the Bangladesh team struggle to breathe in a Delhi cricket match, which is potentially the high point of the game, like that should be elite, almost beyond these kind of fairly pedestrian struggles, that is only going to ram it home. And so again, it's just going to stimulate wider conversation. It's in a weird way, it could prompt some good.
Moving on to some slightly less important news from India in the last week. There have been proposed changes to the IPL. Changes reported on Cricket Info and in the Times of India suggesting we could have no ball umpires and substitutions. Times of India quoted a BCCI official as saying, "We are looking at a scenario where a team will not name the playing 11. They will announce the 15 and a player can be substituted at either the fall of a wicket or the end of the over at any point in the game. Imagine you need 20 runs off the last 6 balls and you have Andre Russell sitting in the dugout as he wasn't 100% fit and wasn't part of the original 11. But now he can just walk in and go slam bang and win you the game." What do you think about that? The substitute rule and having a squad of 15 is actually quite a drastic change.
Look, I quite like it. Because
but it's not cricket.
Well, exactly. It's a bat and a ball and it's people trying to you know, take wickets and score runs, but it's definitely not cricket. Yeah. The point I was going to say really is I don't necessarily like this particular iteration, but the idea of trying to increase the quality of the players involved in a game is interesting. Doesn't mean it's good or bad, but it does change it in a potentially significant way. We've seen it proposed elsewhere, the idea of specialist fielders, so the idea of a bowler, so someone like Harry Gurney bowls his overs and then just runs off and is replaced by Fabian Allen or a brilliant fielder or just whoever you want. Like, you can basically get that, the general standard of play, you can raise it. Doesn't necessarily mean anyone would want to watch that more than watching Harry Gurney desperately try and like dive and save a forward, which could be, you know, has an appeal in an entertainment sense. And a lot of the skill of cricket selection and coaching and playing the game is balancing sides, and that is inherently, you know, you don't want to take away that skill. But at the same time, what we shouldn't be doing is anything like, well, it's always been the case, because you know what, 2020 didn't exist 20 years ago. Mm. Like, it doesn't. These things weren't handed down to us by the gods. We can change them if we think that we can make the game better. And we shouldn't be afraid of
that. One thing that is really important, though, is we must never lose people playing cricket who are totally hopeless at one aspect of the game.
The Jack Leach principle.
The Jack Leach. We need to have that.
Is there any other sport where that happens? Yeah. I was actually having a conversation with someone about this the other day. Is there any other sport where someone has... Sorry.
Well, I was going to say, last night we saw Kyle Walker go in goal for Manchester City.
Yeah,
and it was amazing.
Yeah.
And we don't want to lose that, because that is, you know, there's a fun element of seeing
cricket
someone...
Cricket has that almost every game when number 11 comes
in. An elite athlete doing something that they're not good at.
Yeah,
exactly. It's like a weird version of that old show Superstars, where you get triple jumpers to go swimming and stuff.
Yeah. So this is kind of a similar version of what you said, Ben. So I read the article, and as soon as I saw 15 men, I was like, and not in playing 11, I was like, that's a warm-up game. That's what you do for a warm-up game. Mm. You know, those games where the scorecard is a mess because there's so many different players involved. But I totally agree with what you said about this is the way we've always done it is not a good reason to keep doing it that way. So I'm very interested in baseball, and you have two major leagues in baseball, one where the pitcher also bats, but one with a designated hitter. So you have 9 players and a designated hitter. And it's more interesting to watch a specialist hitter. So
is it? So you prefer watching when everyone is just really good?
Well, no. So you'll see where my argument's going. It's not saying you take out everyone who doesn't have that skill set. Mm. It's kind of a nuanced position between keeping it the way it is and, you know, a 15-man chaotic warm-up game where all 11 players are brilliant batsmen and there's nothing of that sort. So there's two of these leagues, baseball leagues in America. One has changed like this to have a pitcher that also bats, and one hasn't. Mm. So they're both there for people to go and look at, of interest. So one has 9 people plus a designated hitter, because with the idea that people find it more interesting to go to a short form event like that and see a specialist hitter, which I believe is the case. I'm not going to try and speak for all people in cricket. I certainly broadly would posit that. And so they changed the sport to keep the quality higher. And I don't think cricket should be allergic to that idea, and it could work. So, for example, if you had a game here, it'd be the cricketing equivalent, if you put that designated hitter thing in, of sort of what we had years ago with Vikram Solanki and the Super Sub, except done in a slightly different way, whereby Imran Tahir bowls and fields, but Imran Tahir doesn't bat, and you have a guy like Richard Levi, he'd actually be perfect for this, who just comes out and hits. And I'm not saying it has to be Richard Levi. Other hitters are available, and you know, I'm not his agent, but that kind of thing. So it's not saying like, oh, all 11 players are gun batsmen, but it's saying, you know, you have your team, you try and balance your team, but you can actually take out one guy who that's not their skill, and kind of lengthen your batting order, and yeah.
But like we're saying, you shouldn't be allergic to change, because you tweak and you tweak and you tweak, and then eventually you can land on a really good format. Like ODI cricket at the moment, I think, is as entertaining as it's ever been. And that's after basically a decade of fiddling around with it and trying to get it right. And then eventually...
And it not being very good to watch for quite a long period.
Yeah, like not that interesting, not that like potentially like kind of strategically interesting on like a kind of drab level, but like you wouldn't get much out of it as a casual fan. But then before they got that right, they were trying things like the Super Sub and things like that. And the issue with the Super Sub was that it ended up massively favouring one side rather than the other, depending on which way the coin landed. And there might be version or iterations of this particular rule change which are going to come in where they go, okay, we've played a season of it, and actually it doesn't work. We need to change it. Like with VAR in football at the moment, they're like, okay, it's good in principle, but we need to change this. Mm. And that's fine. We should basically be more fluid in what we think is okay to do. Mm. Because I remember we're sat in the OCS stand at the Oval, and I remember I was doing some work here a few years ago for a T20 match where Kevin Peterson was playing for Surrey, and basically he was injured before the game, but he'd hyped it up as like it was one of his big games, but he didn't have a hamstring. Mm. So he basically kind of limped out and then was like, I need a runner. Mm. And there was all this debate between McCollum and kind of the umpires about whether they were allowed it, because it's like, well, it's pre-existing injury. But if Peterson was allowed to be I'm doing the air quotes thing, a designated hitter, he doesn't have to field. He could just come in, give it a swing, and then go off and, and everyone gets to see Kevin Peterson back, but they don't have to see him limping around the outfield. And some people might like that. A lot of people probably wouldn't, but it is worth thinking about. I think a lot of people are instantly just kind of like, whoa, no, hey, whoa. And also because it's the IPL, which scares people, because it happens away from England, and it's kind of a bit exotic and a bit confusing for most people.
I mean, there's something that I want to mention, but don't really want to go into in any detail. There was a story yesterday that the House of Lords have recommended that the Ashes should be shown on free-to-air TV. This is not true. There's a report, and at the end there's a throwaway line where they say that we could extend the list of sporting events that are safeguarded for live free-to-air TV. And if we do extend it, the Ashes could be one that's included. I think it's just an old man, really, who remembered the Ashes exists.
There's a conversation to be had about some free-to-air cricket at some point. The 100 is going to be on free-to-air in part. Mm. There is a conversation to be had there, but it is not to be had in the tired, hackneyed language of the House of Lords recommending that the crown jewels, to kind of coin the phrase, of Sky Cricket's coverage, which is the best cricket coverage in the world, probably, you're looking at taking away their main asset. It's not going to work on an economic level. It won't work.
Also,
and it shouldn't work.
They didn't really suggest it. So it's a total.
I'm in danger of arguing with the point that didn't get made. So I should back off a little bit. Sorry. Yeah.
Let's go to Australia. Australia 1-0 up of the first of their two T20Is against Pakistan. In the first T20I, Australia were 41 for none after 3.1 overs when the game was called off. The DLS pass score for 5 overs, the minimum required for a full T20I, was 39. So Australia already had enough runs. That just seems like quite a simple oversight in the rules, and that's a very easy one to change.
It's a system so confusing that Yaz has had to record this twice because he got it wrong the first time. It's a bit of an oversight, isn't it? DLS is, it's a slightly imperfect measure for 2020, you could say.
But not even DLS's fault, is it? That's just poor implementation of a system that they used.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I think they should just use WinViz and see whoever's ahead on WinViz whenever they go off, and they just... We could do it at the start of the game. Don't even need to play it, to be honest.
I wonder why you said that. Steve Smith hit 80 not out on the second T20I. So from a cricket point of view, that's much more interesting. Ben, is he a shoo-in for Australia's 11 at the T20 World Cup next year?
I think he is. Whether he should be is probably a little bit more of a debate, but I doubt...
But after what he's done now, he's going to be.
Right, I'll give surely. I'll say what I think, and I think you're going to disagree with it. I think that Steve Smith, Joe Root, Kane Williamson, they have just got to play, because you gave the scenario early in the podcast of a team being two for two.
Oh, no.
And there's no one else in the world I'd rather have in those situations than those guys. That doesn't mean they have to bat three every single time.
And this reminded me of that. I know this is the because I saw it on your Twitter feed, and I agreed with your replies where people were like, they were one for one, and you were like, it's like a 98%. So,
But yeah, that was in discussion of the idea that was a previous innings, that was in Brisbane, I think, where they were, Australia basically were going to win, but Smith came in and kind of cleaned up. That's a different conversation. That innings wasn't very interesting. This innings was interesting because it hinted at something that Smith hasn't done in a while, which is just going to that next gear where he's not just an anchor, because you know what anchors do? They slow ships down. You don't want to be an anchor in T20. Mm. He hinted at being able to go to the next level, and actually there were a couple of things that he did, a couple of shots that he played. I mean, everyone kind of focused on that weird one where he kind of did the periscope and it came off the back of the bat and the ball went into space or whatever. Like, everyone focused on that one, but the more interesting one, which was my moment of the week, but Yaz has forgotten to ask me.
No, I was waiting for this part of the show, actually.
There was a moment when Mohammed Irfan bowled two balls to Smith that were just outside off stump, and someone clipped it up on Twitter. I can't remember who it was, I'm afraid. And basically, one ball, Smith played a kind of flaying cover drive, kind of drive come cut kind of thing. It was amazing. And it sent it to the offside boundary. And then the next ball, he kind of did his weird wrist shimmy oddness and hit it away to the mid wicket boundary, and it was amazing. And it just showed that, like, fundamentally, and this is an argument I've had with Freddie Wilde of Quick Visit a few times, is that he places a lot of emphasis on the idea that Steve Smith is a genius with a bat in his hand, and that actually he will overcome any issues that he has in T20 in terms of his power hitting because he is a genius.
And yeah, and he probably won't even sleep till he has.
Yeah, well, he doesn't need to. He's going to spend next year not sleeping and practicing in the nets. And he, you know, that could genuinely be true. But there is a greater potential to what Smith can do than potentially someone like Joe Root, who is, whilst a very good player in Test cricket and a great player in ODI cricket, he's not necessarily got the same range. We saw it when he played for the Thunder last year in the BBL, and when he does play T20 cricket, he looks good. And I know a lot of people place a lot of emphasis on that great South Africa innings. Your editor Phil Walker, or your senior Phil Walker rather. And I know people obviously call back to that innings, but I think a lot of that is just because people don't watch a lot of T20 cricket outside World Cups.
It was an astonishing innings, and Joe
it was, it
and
really
Root
was.
Hasn't played that much T20 cricket in the time since. Which is a long period of time not to have played that much in.
I think the difference is that, I mean, fundamentally, I think that Steve Smith's just better than Joe Root. And so I think you can, when you're talking about your Williamsons, your Williamsons, your Roots, your Smiths, you're talking about three very different players there. Mm. Kane Williamson, the reason he's so good is he plays for Sunrisers, and he generally plays on a terrible deck where you need to place a lot of emphasis on his ability to kind of problem solve that. Mm. And Smith has been getting to that point in various innings, whereas Joe Root, we don't really know what his skill set is in that. Is he someone who can strike at 160, or is he just there as the anchor? We don't know, because we don't see him play T20 cricket. Mm. So my issue is that if you don't see someone play T20 cricket, you shouldn't really be selecting them, because if the rest of the world isn't thinking that they're valuable, then why would England? That's a bit blunt.
I see where you're coming from, but I do place great emphasis on that knock against Africa. He was brilliant in a team that was an over away from winning the last version of the T20 World Cup. So
did they not win? I turned off with an over.
And I think kind of using Freddie's argument about Steve Smith, I use that with Joe Root. Joe Root is so naturally talented,
yeah,
and I think that the possibilities are endless. I think if he concentrates on T20 cricket for a prolonged period of time.
The point with Australia, though, is that Steve Smith is locked in. He is going to play next year because they have identified him as the linchpin in their batting lineup. Mm. He is the key cog. Mm. Personally, I would say David Warner should be that guy, maybe dropping out of the opening partnership and batting three, because I think he can do everything Smith does and more. Mm. But Australia have made that call, and I think it's right to make it a year in advance, because then you give the project the best chance of working,
yeah,
even if it's not necessarily the best plan. You're giving it a better chance of working than just dropping him in, you know, 3 weeks before and saying go and have a couple of hits against, you know, someone in the warm-up.
Mm. The last week also saw the end of the T20 World Cup qualifier, so we know the six teams going to the World Cup in Australia, and the competition actually came to an end, because after all the six teams qualified, there was a semi-final and final stage to decide the winner. Netherlands won it, PNG came second, Namibia, Scotland, Ireland and Oman will be going to the World Cup. I was out there. So I'm just going to quickly run through what I thought about those six teams, because I think they're all interesting in their own right. Netherlands, I think, will do very well in Australia. They've got a very well balanced side. They've got a good pace attack. Van Meekeren, Van de Gooten, they actually were quick, and they did really well on quite slow surface in the UAE. And I think in Australia they'll do even better. So I say, out of the associate teams most likely to qualify for the Super 12, I'd say Netherlands are comfortably first. PNG are a really interesting team. They're very good in the field. They're very clever with the ball. They lack batting firepower. I think on quicker surfaces, they'll struggle. Namibia are an impressive team in terms of that out of all the teams in the competition, they definitely have the most depth in their batting. A lot of teams are very top heavy. They have finishers, which at that level, actually teams don't really have. Scotland really struggled. I think they were quite lucky to qualify for the World Cup. They struggled, I think, a lot because of the conditions. So I think in Australia, they'll potentially do quite well. Ireland are developing. I think that Gareth Delaney was a great find. He bowls like quite fast leg spin and can bat in the top order. He scored a brilliant, arguably, innings of the tournament, 89 against Oman. A game that if Ireland didn't win, they might not have even qualified. And lastly, Oman themselves. Odd team. They finished sixth, but I think in many ways the most impressive team in the tournament. They've got the best individual players, in my opinion. Bilal Khan, I think, is going to be the star of the T20 World Cup next year. He's a 31-year-old left arm quick who just swings it miles, and he bowls accurate Yorkers at any level. That's impressive. He's a lot like David Willey. We were talking about David Willey earlier in the show, but he bowls probably about Willie's pace, maybe slightly quicker. He's taller than Willie. He swings it loads and just bowls loads of Yorkers. He, particularly in that group stage, is going to be really, really difficult to handle. So Binal Khan, remember the name. We'll finish today's show talking a bit about, Michael, your time at the European Cricket League, which I think is quite interesting. And you were talking about it to me before we started recording. A very impressive professional setup for a tournament where the level of cricket was in some ways quite amateur.
Absolutely. I'm going to start by saying that something that links the European Cricket League and your previous link, which is, and I have to declare an interest in saying this, but my co-commentator at the European Cricket League, Ryan Campbell, Netherlands head coach, congrats to them and all of their guys. But I am not at all surprised in that we were chatting about the upcoming qualifiers while we were at the ECL and that side that he'd assembled and how many different of those, going to try and remember how to speak, but how many of those different players had got county exposure and how he's worked really hard to create a very good pipeline for how the next generation coming through can get that kind of exposure that kind of brings them on another level with the next progression idea, with the view to the fact that someone, a franchise, might at some point take a chance on a Max O'Dowd in a low price bracket as an opener who can hit a long ball, and you know, kind of that pipeline of using the T20 franchise leagues and the way things have evolved as a platform for these associate players. And it was really nice to see them do well, and I think they'll do bits in
Australia. Actually, one more thing before we go on the ECL. One team I didn't mention was Jersey. Don't be surprised if Jersey qualify for a World Cup in the not too distant future. They were one win away from qualifying in the top six in the group stage, which would have taken them to the World Cup, and they're a really young team. Their best players are all under the age of 24. There's a guy called Jonty Jenner who's really excellent.
And it's interesting you mention that, because ECL founder Dan Weston won't be necessarily chuffed with me mentioning this because it wasn't obviously a great time for him. But his side, he was part of the Germany side that were very close to Jersey in qualifying, and it came down to a minuscule margin by which Jersey got through. So we ended
Ollie Rainer's Germany.
We ended up kind of chatting about them, and he was like, yeah, they're an impressive group of sort of young players. But again, the strength and depth that is building in associate cricket is shown by the fact that Jersey went and did that, and they only just got there. Like, by it was net run rate, and it was tiny, and Germany thrashed Jersey when they played each other in the head-to-head, but it was Germany losing to Italy that cost them, and then Germany had a chase they had to win in X amount of time.
And Nepal didn't even qualify for the qualifier. It's quite interesting.
Yeah.
I'm going to be quite controversial and say that it shows the depth at a lower level, but I think it shows that the quality at the top end of associate cricket is not perhaps what it was a couple of years ago. So I don't think Ireland are as good. I know they're not an associate team. Ireland are not as good as they were a few years ago. Afghanistan are no longer even in the qualifying tournament. Zimbabwe weren't there.
Irish team had a life cycle, didn't they?
That
generation.
It's a transitional period for them.
You just desperately wanted them to play Test cricket.
What's really exciting, because I don't watch a huge amount of associate cricket. I watch it when it's on television and I can kind of easily drop onto it. And so I've enjoyed watching the qualifiers. And it's an old thing of just like getting to see fresh players and fresh faces. It's always exciting. But I think the structure of the tournament next year is going to work really well in terms of building that momentum and that kind of narrative, because I remember at the 2016 World T20, everyone got really excited about a couple of Afghanistan players because it was like the first time that most people had seen them, and by having those teams just kind of whetting everyone's appetite before the tournament starts, it means that there's going to be narrative circling around players that are maybe kind of flying a little bit under the radar, and then by the time they reach the tournament, everyone's going to be like, oh, okay, yeah, so I know that I want to watch them. But it was like a bit like in the World Cup when everyone suddenly discovered Hazratullah, and everyone was like, oh yeah, I want to watch him back. And it was partly because there have been a few clips that have gone around of him, and he'd kind of done bits in various leagues around the world. But having that little pre-tournament should kind of, I don't know, I think that could really improve the experience of the associate players and how people experience them.
And it's really good there are 12, it's a super 12 rather than a super 10. I think that's really important.
It's going to be great.
Yeah, can't wait. Do you want to explain a little bit to our listeners what the ECL was?
Yes.
And then explain quite the production levels behind it, because you were saying that it's one of the most impressive tournaments you've actually worked on as a commentator.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been very lucky in that across hockey, football, tennis, I've worked on outside broadcasts as a commentator or presenter or both in different parts of the world, different well-known companies. Got involved with the ECL through was introduced through a friend who runs the ECL website, Mark Lovell. And most of the ECL crew were kind of broadly, a lot of them kind of people that knew Dan Weston from his Perth roots or had kind of come through the journey of German cricket TV, which is where they started going out and filming games. Mm. And then particularly with the immigrant community, but also with Germans picking it up as well, it exploded because a lot of people were in Germany thinking, I love cricket, but cricket doesn't exist in Germany. And then they saw it on Facebook and were like, oh my God, it does. And the number of clubs just mushroomed overnight. I'm not going to quote numbers because I don't have them, but Dan has them. But we're talking a huge increase. And that evolved into what eventually became the European Cricket League. So the European Cricket League is the Champions League of European cricket. And unlike the Champions League now, where you finish fourth in the English domestic league and you still get a spot, you win your domestic T20 league in the T20 format, to be clear, because there's also some with 40, 50 over formats, you get to the ECL. So I'm going to mention Pavel Florin because it's inevitable. They won the Romanian T20 domestic league, Cluj, his team. That got them to the European Cricket League. And we all know what happened next. They won the Romanian league this year. So they'll be back next summer. That's the way it works. And it's so last year you had eight teams, all champions of their own leagues. It's not exactly giving anything away to say that it's going to be bigger and better because it's going from a three-day tournament to a sort of 7 or 8 day tournament, I think now, from the 31st of May to the 7th of June. I hope I've got that right. I'm pretty sure I have. So already announced, you've got the champions from Sweden, Belgium, Finland and Norway all joining. You initially had, oh, this is like a test now remembering them all, but you had France, Romania, Spain, Germany. There's some I've forgotten and I feel terrible, but you get the message. They're going double Dutch, so VOC Rotterdam won it, and if you win, then you get to come back. And so basically the runners up in the Dutch competition are coming as well, so there'll be two Dutch teams. There's more where that came from. I'm going to do that thing that a politician does where they always say, like, I'm not going to reveal my policy on your programme, Evan, you know, and all that things where politicians get questioned because that's for Dan and everyone to reveal at the appropriate moment. But that's kind of the broad format.
The level of production, though, was really high. It was broadcast. The question was there a demand for this tournament? How's that level of production funded?
Well, I mean, in terms of...
Because it's an amazing thing for it to exist, yeah, so, and to be able to watch it in that great detail.
So it's all the brainchild of Dan Weston, who has kind of turned his vision into a reality. And ultimately, it's, you know, like any tournament in the long term, you know, they're actively looking for sponsors for this year coming, and to kind of keep it growing and keep it expanding, because you have to kind of manage your things in a responsible way. And I know the first year of the ECL, you know, it was done in a very professional way without being kind of reckless in the way it was planned. Mm. I was, in terms of the broadcast output, I mean, you had NEP, who are a very, very well-known production company. Just to give you a little story rather than just giving dry stats, there was a guy, Ross was his name, who I had the pleasure of being at the England-Sri Lanka series in Palakkad and Colombo. And I met this guy, Ross, who was doing... the cameraman for World Feed from the bowler's arm, which is a very specific job. You know, you can only do that if you're a specialist. It's not the kind of thing that every cameraman can do because you've got to track a cricket ball, right? You know, if you don't know where the ball's going to turn and you follow it the wrong way, the pictures are missed, etc., etc. Now, Ross was on the camera gantry in Palakkad and Colombo, and then, not to my surprise, that'd be too far to say, but I was still pleasantly surprised when first day of the ECL, Ross was there. And that really gave me a thing of, like, I already knew, you know, by that point what a big, serious thing was and how awesome this was going to be. But you saw someone like that there and you were like, yeah, there's been no corner cutting with this. Mm-hmm. You know, when I first got involved a few months out and was only hearing bits and bobs off emails, you're there thinking, well, maybe in the back of your head, you're like, are they going to do maybe a two camera thing or four camera thing? You know, like you see most kind of streaming thing, or what are we going to do? And then it was only kind of when I got there a week before and the ground started getting developed at La Manga and the LED boards and all of the ECL branding and then the team kits, which were absolutely on point, the umpires' kits, all of that sort of thing. And then it was like, you've got 30 cameras and the rest of it, you were like, wow, this is, you know, this is going to be a serious thing. And now that's been done, it now gives something whereby sponsors before who might be like, cricket in Europe, like, is that a, you can now go to them and say, well, here it is, it was on TV across the world, including, you know, Fox Australia, Sky New Zealand, 100 plus countries, streamed online at ecl.cricket. It's there, it's happened. Like, look at the, what, you know, with Pavel as well, look at how many people were talking about it one way or another. And actually, once people got on the front foot on social media with a Pavel flowing story and were like, look, this guy was a bodyguard, he is a bodyguard. 6 years ago, he'd never played cricket. He basically came across some, this is by his own mode, some guys who are playing cricket who he went and hit the ball a couple of times. And they kind of were being, by his own admission, very charitable to him in their praise and said, like, oh, you know, you're brilliant. You could be the first Romanian to be fantastic at cricket. And he sort of said, oh, OK, I think you're kind of being too nice, but I'll join in. 6 years later, he's president of a cricket club. They have to have a 5-hour drive from Cluj to Bucharest one way to play every single game, you know, often in total darkness. Isn't this the kind of story we want? Like, I found it very odd. There was, I know Twitter isn't a great place for debate sometimes, I'm going to say, but you had people on Twitter who would be unhappy about the lack of cricket growing, expanding, maybe not being on free to air, etc., etc. But then someone like Pavel comes along, and some people, sometimes those same people or other people, would turn into huge cricket snobs. Mm. And you're like, well, this is the first Romanian-born kind of player emerging. What are you expecting? Mm. I found it was interesting. I got on the front foot on Twitter. As soon as that happened, I was at the back of the commentary box when we first came onto bowl, and tweets started flying in. This is off my own account, not the ECL account. And it was all these people, this kind of cancel culture. It's like, oh, the ECL should be cancelled. Oh, Pavel Florin should be cancelled. And I replied to a few people, not being rude, but just like, I put a thread out with the story, as did a few people. And I also just replied, not being rude, but just like stating what I've just stated about his journey. And then they'd come back and say, oh, no, mate, well, I was only joking. And you're like, okay, well, what you've actually written is pretty, pretty stinging. Mm. You're saying like the whole competition shouldn't exist, or like he's a joke. Actually, he's not. He's an inspiration. Like, I'm proud to call him a friend now. And if you want cricket to grow in Europe, you should be encouraging a tournament like this and somebody like him.
I think it's tricky, isn't it? Because I'm not sure cancel culture is quite the right word, but or quite the right phrase. But there is a kind of life cycle to opinions on Twitter where they kind of, everyone has to have a reaction to something straight away, and then so someone gets it wrong and then you have to react to that, and then that becomes the correct opinion. Yeah. And so it gets silly and it's unnecessary. I certainly didn't go as far as to kind of criticize what was happening, or when I saw that clip, you feel like, oh, that's, you know, it's kind of weird to see someone really bad at cricket like playing with all the really good graphics, and it's this really hyper, it's jarring, and you can have that reaction. You think, oh, that's weird. I feel strange about that. If your reaction is to think like, I this guy's rubbish, I don't want to see him, hey, he shouldn't be allowed to play cricket, da-da-da, then that's one thing. To have the reaction of thinking like, this is odd.
is
one thing. And yeah. I think a lot of the time with cricket, because it's obviously a really heartwarming story, but I think we often get sold the kind of English village green kind of, oh, isn't it the hearty amateur, the beautiful amateur game kind of thing. And actually, it's quite nice to have a variation on that. It's not just like, oh yeah, I grew up in Tunbridge Wells and my father played for my father's 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 team. It's nice to be like, okay, yeah, this guy from Romania has actually come out of nowhere. Mm. And like, you know, the story has pros and cons, but it's nice that it's something different at the very least. Mm. It's not a hackneyed cliche.
I think it was really good that eventually from all this, it was turned into a really positive story, and that was all really, really interesting. Thank you so much.
Sorry for the ramble.
No, not at all. Thank you both for coming on, folks. Hope you enjoyed the show. Please subscribe, tell your friends. We'll be back next week. See ya.